Question of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in the genre, but had their life changed by it in a major way. And today on the show, the legend, there's no other way to put it, the front man of Lard, the front person of the Dead Kennedys, of Guantanamo School of Medicine, the owner of Alternative Tentacles Records, arguably the most influential vocalist to come out of hardcore, Jello Biafra is on the show today. Oh my gosh, it's a good one. But more on that in a second. First, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to DamienAbraham.com. There's an email address there. You can send me an email. You can find me on various forms of social media at Left for Damien. To support this show, the best way to do that is to go over to iTunes and to subscribe to this podcast, write a review, rate it, or tell all your friends, check this thing out on Spotify and all other things, put it on your Spotify playlist and all, you know, just generally advertise for free for me. That's the best way to do it. And speaking of sponsoring and supporting this show is presented to you and brought to you by the good folks at Vans. Vans shoes, of course, are, you know, helping me out this summer and making me be able to do this podcast and finally be able to, you know, get some new gear and do all sorts of fun stuff like go to the House of Vans shows, which is what I'm going to be doing today as soon as I'm done recording this intro and you can check out this podcast. So if you're listening to this podcast today, the day it dropped, I'm going to be in New York City or Brooklyn, New York, in fact, for the House of Vans show featuring the Downtown Boys and Royal Headache. If you are in New York today, I think it's already all filled up, the RSVP. But if not, go to houseofvans.com. There's going to be a list of all the other great House of Vans events happening all summer. You know, like this one that's happening today featuring the Royal Headache people and the Downtown Boys people. Two bands that I've always wanted to have on this show. And now I'm going to get to go and do that live in New York. So go over to houseofvans.com. Check it out. Thank you once again to the people at Vans for, you know, making this possible and getting me able to, you know, go and fly around and do all this fun stuff. You know, they've helped me out. You don't have to do any surveys. You don't have to do anything else. So that's all they want me to do is tell you about that. So, you know, Vans has, you know, made it possible for me to do this. So thank you very much to them. Go out there and check out houseofvans.com. And I will see you in New York. Get there early because we're going to be pulling 30 or 40 people from that line to come in and see this podcast. So get down to the House of Vans in Brooklyn. Line up early if you can, because I'm going to be there to do this live, which is awesome. Because that's, you know, really one of the most fun ways I get to do this podcast is when I get to do it live. So if you are there, I will see you this evening. And thank you once again to Chuck and Brooke and everyone at Vans for making this so easy for me to do. On to today's show. Today on the show, I gotta thank my good pal, friend of the show, former guest, someone that's aided the show in incalculable ways. She has helped us get incredible guests on this show. She has babysat some guests that had to come on this show. And she just has really set this up. I'm talking about my friend Melanie Kay. She is someone that works publicity for a lot of bands. But in this case, she just did it because she wanted to see Jello Biafra on the show, who's a friend of hers. And she made this happen. So I really got to thank Melanie so much for you know, putting this all together. Also, Eric Duell, Melanie's husband, former member of the band The Exploders, a future guest because he is an awesome, awesome friend and someone that put up with a lot of record nerddom. He's a record nerd himself, but I think Jello and my obsession with records challenges even the most nerdy of record nerds with our ability to look at records for just hours and hours and hours. And poor Eric was stuck having to figure out car logistics and all sorts of other things and was unable to enjoy the record shopping itself for the most part. So Eric and Melanie, thank you both for making this happen. And I think you both owe Melanie and Eric a thank you as well, because In the words of my brother, Tristan Abraham, the producer of this show, this is the best one yet. So I'm not going to say that. I don't know if it is the best one yet. I'm going to leave that to you to judge. But it is, I think, a great one. I had a really fun time recording it. Jello Biafra, for those of you who don't know, is someone that changed the face of the genre of punk and hardcore forever. Changed the face of music with the Tipper Gore PMRC stuff and the challenges they had to freedom of expression and that he had to fight for. Jello is someone that, like, you've listened to this show before. If you've checked out past episodes, you've heard that how many times the Dead Kennedys come up as people's first exposure to this. They're certainly one of my first exposures to this, and they are a band, and he is a person, I should say, that continues to kind of embody the ethos that he's had the whole time. Like, Jello is one of those people that you can set your watch by in the way that he kind of governs his business, because he has decided that he wants to do things a certain way and has made sure and had to fight to make sure that he can do that stuff in a certain way. He is someone that I find incredibly inspiring, not just as a front person in a band, but as a record collector, his taste in music, his ability to kind of explore weirder esoteric genres and things like that has inspired me to do the same. I'm very, very excited for you to hear this. I don't want to blather on too much longer because you want to hear this. So I'm just going to leave it to that. There's nothing really more for me to say. This is a fun one. Once again, everyone, tonight at the House of Vans in Brooklyn, New York, for the Royal Headache Show with Downtown Boys, come out and see this thing live. And sit back, relax, and enjoy Jello Biafra on Turned Out a Punk. Our friend King Khan tried to set this up too, and so I feel like this is completing a dream of his and mine right now.
Well, yeah, he meant well, but I do have protocol for this. For example, if we're in the same room and there isn't a bunch of other important things, like going through record bins that precludes it, here we are. I mean, I get hit up for so many interviews. I decline almost all of them because it would be all I would do otherwise. Another rule with all the people: I'm writing a book about anarchism. I'm writing a book about the history of punk. I'm making a documentary about this particular band or whatever. All of those, my rule is, I'm the last person you interview. And sadly, in a way, it means that 90% of them then don't happen because somebody didn't finish their project.
Well, we are now hundreds of episodes in. And the reason this is so important that you come on this podcast is you are many people's first exposure to punk and hardcore.
It is an honor to be a gateway drug.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and also, not just a gateway drug, I think a gateway ambassador. Because I think what you embodied and what you still embody, as far as, you know, looking at the world from a cynical, intelligent perspective, like, that's one of the greatest takeaways anyone can take from punk.
Yeah, I think part of that is just trying to encourage people not to be afraid of their own curiosity and their own intelligence. I mean, East Bay Ray has gone on record saying he thought my lyrics were too complicated and that they should have been censored and whatnot, but I don't mind putting in references so obscure that you really have to challenge yourself. What's that? I want to find out what that is, which, of course, with Googling and everything, is easier than it's ever been. So it's nice to run into as many people, late teens, early 20s, as I do, who know where I got my name from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the surreal way the two images collide in the mind. Jello, of course, we know what that is. And then Biafra was a part of Nigeria, the southeast corner, who tried to secede in the late 60s. And maybe that war lasted into the early 70s. It was overshadowed, of course, by Vietnam. But there were relief missions. Even Kurt Vonnegut, among others, was involved in that. Because the Nigerian army, with a little bit of British and even some American help, surrounded the attempted Republic of Biafra. And starved him to death, basically. Choked him off, and so all the pictures of the starving Biafran children lying all over the ground, bloated with their eyes out, and it was just gut-wrenching. And it was also back in the time when they had actually show things like that and actual war casualties on the evening news, and then instead of the sanitized Anderson Cooper's concerned face on one side of the screen and some yapping punditoid they hired from a modeling agency on the other side of the screen talking about the same Donald Trump scandal for the next 45 minutes to avoid talking about anything else, let alone showing footage of the same kind of thing, what drones do when they blow somebody up, or what's really going on in Syria or some of the other battles against ISIS, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Well, before you became Biafra
is basically the recognized worldwide symbol of starvation and genocide.
Well, I wanted,
and that's why I used it.
Well, that's the thing. It's like that, you know, your name Jell-O Biafra. Like that's the one of the Mount Rushmore of this entire genre. And I want to take you back though to before that name came into place.
When you're just saying that because I have rocks in my head. Is that what you
saying? I'm saying that because you put the rock in my head, the punk rock in my head, Jell-O. But I wanted to take you back to when you first heard punk. Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
It wasn't a genre yet, okay, defined that way. I mean, I would say the closest relative that I got into the earliest would probably be when I found out about this used record store near my high school called Trade a Tape and Records, and you couldn't listen before you buy in there yet, but they had 50 cent and 25 cent records. And I'd already been liberated the year before when I bought Tyranny and Mutation by the Blue Oyster Cult just on a whim, because I just got this hunch it might be good, and it was on sale. And, you know, 2 weeks later, maybe 1 week, it was my favorite album and stuff. So I thought, aha, I'm not going to rely on radio, even smooth FM radio, that might grudgingly play a Uriah Heep song in between smoothly talking about the Eagles and Dave Mason, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't need that anymore. I'm just going to go by hunches now. Not all of them turned out, but at the same time, and I probably talked about this in Crate Diggers and some of the others, but, you know, being in the, you know, outside of Denver, Colorado was kind of a cultural desert to try and find out what was really going on. It was one of the ground zero testing grounds for who's going to be the next Eagles or Firefall, and then we'll
John Denver country.
Swap it out with a Scientology jazz fusion. Well, now Denver, he was from Texas, actually. Real name John Offenheimer, I believe. But anyway, what I have access to, you know, every Sunday we'd get the Sunday Denver Post delivered. And, oh, something about Alice Cooper. Well, no, it was the local critic lambasting Alice Cooper for being Alice Cooper. He could probably write pretty ballads. Who is this writer? But then I noticed this writer, Jared Johnson, seemed to have an encyclopedic knowledge of things he didn't like. He would say that Paul Simon and the Bee Gees were the greatest composers of the 20th century, but then he'd get things like, Black Sabbath is almost as bad as the MC5. I thought, who are the MC5? I must find out more. And then off to Trade a Tape, and there's a 50 cent MC5 album and stuff. And that was back in the USA, which I didn't realize wasn't the best one then, but at least then quickly led me to find Kick Out the Jams, and then things really started happening. And by then, I'd at least read a review in the one issue of Rolling Stone I somehow had access to of Raw Power by Iggy and the Stooges, but I couldn't figure out what on earth it was, because the review just says, the Ig. Nobody does it better. Nobody does it worse. In fact, nobody does it at all. And I thought that was, it was either Lenny Kaye or Lester Bangs who wrote that review. It's like, but still, what is this record? And then we found connected to the Detroit thing, MC5, Raw Power comes in to trade a tape. Well, I guess before that I found the first album in the 50 Cent bin. Yeah, this is pretty good. And then Raw Power was way better. And then another Denver Post critic named G. Brown dumped his collection at Trade a Tape. So they're trying to sell through it for a dime a piece. And there was Funhouse sealed. So life improved even more. So maybe that was the beginning of the exposure to punk, unless you count, you know, the sheer ferocity of Born to Be Wild by Steppenwolf and how much that band scared people at the time. Oh, they're singing about drugs because of The Pusher, even though that was an anti-drug song, one of the most powerful ones ever written. And, or you can go rewind further because I first discovered or got turned on to rock and roll by accident by my father playing with a radio dial to get me to go to sleep when I was in second grade. And I hear rock and roll, I want it. I like this. And then there was no stopping me. And quickly, I mean, the Beatles were the one you could identify with so other people would know you liked the music. But I would much preferred early Rolling Stones and Paul Revere and the Raiders, who never get the credit they deserve for how many other local, you know, back from the grave and Pebbles chestnuts of bands were copying them. Yeah. Yeah. You know, the Pretty Things were not exactly well known in this country, so until Mike Stax went to work years after the fact, but Raiders were everywhere.
So,
and so I got into a lot of that, you know. It was so, plus, at that point, the station in Denver, KIMN, played local bands. So the Moonrakers, who have great garage singles, were on the air. The Astronauts were on the air. And then you had the one-offs like Psychotic Reaction and the Music Machine. And I kept track of those in my head later because I always liked them. Even the really early Bob Seger stuff that got on the radio, Ramblin' Gamblin' Man, and then Lucifer, those are great songs.
So were you getting, like, it's just from rock radio and by trial and error that you're finding out about this stuff? Did you have any peers that were into rock music like you were?
To some degree.
Yeah.
To some degree, although I don't think it was till after I was out of high school that another one of my good friends got into the Stooges and record collecting too, and then a third one did, who was Joseph Pope, who'd later go on to co-found Angst, the SST band and stuff. So, but it was overall, it was pretty lonely being about the only person who liked this stuff or even seemed to like Black Sabbath for the most part in a town. I mean, sure the jocks liked Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin too, but they were the jocks.
Exactly.
Well, they were at football practice. I was at Trade a Tape.
So I guess, like, you're finding out about this stuff, you're kind of connecting these dots yourself. It's amazing also with Blue Oyster Cult how that band is so important as, like, a proto-punk band. Like, from, you know, Patti Smith working with them to What's-His-Face from Vom writing songs for them, too. Like, they have so many connections, and then, of course, exposing you to it, too.
Yeah, well, it's more those tenuous connections than them sounding punk,
yeah,
shall we say.
Yeah.
Although,
in Sniffing Glue, though, they give, I remember, like, in the first issue of Sniffing Glue, they give Blue Oyster Cult a glowing review. Like, Mark
which
Smith,
one?
It's like, I forget which one. It's one of the early issues. He's like,
surely not Secret Treaties.
I don't know. I'm trying to remember.
Surely not the one with Don't Fear the Reaper on it.
No, definitely not that
the
one.
The only ones I can think of would be Tyranny and Mutation and that live album, On Your Feet or On Your Knees.
I'm going to check that.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Check
I wonder,
it in the intro.
Wonder which one that was.
But so you're connecting all these dots yourself at this point. When did you kind of realize that there was, like, a little bit of an undercurrent scene? I guess it hadn't galvanized to a scene yet, but, like, when were you kind of picking up on those pieces at this point?
Well, the first time I saw the term punk used, it was just to describe what's now called 60s garage.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people don't call it 60s punk anymore because that term got abused too much, basically. And, yeah, the grassroots are 60s punk. No, I don't think so. But so, same as the overused terms like heavy psych, or now everything gets labeled titty shaker and stuff. And
really? I haven't heard that one yet.
It's supposed to be a particular kind of dance and jungly,
okay,
rhythm and bluesy voodoo novelty stuff.
Okay.
And
Stranded in the Jungle might qualify. I don't know. I'm trying to think of some more, but that there's a lot of there's entire compilations of it and stuff. But,
were there local bands that you're like you mentioned the Astronauts and stuff? Were there local bands that you were seeing at that point?
I didn't get to see anybody. Yeah. You know, I was 7 years old. I mean, the closest I came to see the Astronauts was when the leader Bob Demon, whose mother ran the office at my elementary school, came to our second grade class to show us his dog. And me and one other girl in the class knew who he was. Like days were, Bob Demon's coming to our school. Bob Demon's coming to our school. And then he shows up, but he might not have been afraid of like a big crowd of rowdy people at Tulagi's nightclub wanting to hear him play. But a room of second graders was another story. Yeah, well, he's called a Malamute and doesn't really say much. And walking down the aisle, you can pet him if you want. And that was my first encounter with a rock star.
So were there, like, you're 7 years old, you know, but punk eventually starts kind of happening. What are the first sort of signposts you see that there's, like, this new music kind of revolution going on?
Well, the Ramones already had one, maybe, yeah, it's got to be just one album out. And then the main clerk at Trader Tape in later years, Rick Stott, who would eventually come out to the Bay Area after I did, and for a while was the board op who was part of the Maximum Rock and Roll radio show. He was going to law school and stuff. But anyway, he said, yeah, I've heard about there's this whole compilation of New York City punk bands called Live at CBGB's. And he just heard about it. That was all. I was like, what could this mean? And then a store opened in Denver, and I see the ad in the college paper, like, oh my God, there's Yardbirds picture sleeves in the ad. What is this store? And I go to the store, it's called Wax Tracks, and there is John Denver's Greatest Hits with nails in his eyes, with blood coming down on the front door. And I walk in, and here's these guys with way shorter hair than most 70s people, leather jacket, no shirt on, handing me a joint and whatnot, and that would be Jim Nash and Danny Flesher, and that store turned out to be quite the electrifying meeting place. I mean, they were really into glam and Bowie and New York Dolls and Roxy Music and Gene Vincent and some other things. And little did I know that they were openly gay as well, which was almost unheard of then. So they helped build that underground scene in Denver as well, which took no small amount of nerve. But they also began paying attention to what was going on in Britain, as in Sex Pistols, as in shortly after Anarchy in the UK came out. It's still has not been refuted, to my knowledge, that the first copies anywhere in the United States showed up at Wax Tracks.
Oh, wow.
And whenever they do some outrageous thing or vomit on themselves at a press conference just to annoy everybody, you know, the papers would come over, so that would go up on the wall. This is important, guys. And sure enough, it was. And then singles began coming in. And I heard one was probably Neat, Neat, Neat by The Damned, who didn't have the album out yet. I was like, oh my God, what is that? What is that? Just some punk single from England. And that way, I wasn't even allowed to touch it or look at it or something. And, you know, Nash was a man of strong opinions in many ways, but give me all kinds of shit for buying krautrock things out of their used bins. A lot of synthesizer stuff. What are you buying that for? And then word gets around the Ramones are coming to Denver, and they were opening for a radio rock band called Night City, the one with Ray Manzarek and Nigel Harris and Pre-Blondie in it. And Prima Donna. It was just boring FM radio rock, though, and stuff. Not real good.
Quite the lineup, though.
But the, at least those two.
Yeah.
But the opener was the Ramones. And so we go down there, and there's a little horseshoe at this little, you know, major label testing ground place where all the music industry people with their Kenny Loggins dues and their neatly trimmed beards and corduroy jackets with patches on them and whatnot, they're all there to look at Night City. And there's their women who just had their hair done 20 style because Joni Mitchell just did with little flowers and stuff. And then surrounding the front of the stage was people who were there to see the Ramones, who at that point, I liked them, but I also thought they were kind of funny because the songs were so short and lyrics like beat on the brat with a baseball bat or now I want to sniff some glue and now I have something to do. And those were the entire lyrics of the song. What is this? So me and some of my other friends would occasionally put that on in between tripping out on krautrock or prog rock records while smoking a bunch of weed.
As a palate cleanser.
Or something, yeah. But of course I had to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, by then there was a little bit of a buzz that this could wind up being something important. And then these four degenerate-looking guys in black leather jackets come out and one chord on Johnny's guitar, and you knew it was going to be way louder than anybody was prepared for, and Ebbets Field was a sit-down club. You couldn't leave. You had to sit there and watch the Ramones, even if you were a big music executive and stuff, sitting behind these creepy misfits in the front row. And that was part of the fun, was just watching these people be more and more terrified. Please make it stop. No, more. Yes, 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 more. And they were so powerful, yet so simple. And I was starting to think, God, anybody could do this. I could do this. Maybe I should do this. Finally, I have a purpose in life. And meanwhile, Joseph Pope had gone backstage because it was two sets a night kind of thing. I'm like, yeah, I was just backstage talking to the Ramones. You can talk to a rock star? Wow. Unheard of. So back we went and we're hanging with the Ramones. And then Rick Stott talked both Ebbets, because he had a radio show in Boulder too, and people kind of knew who he was. He talked Ebbets Field into opening the next night and letting the Ramones have a headline gig because they didn't have a gig. And then turned out the Ramones, that during the day they went to Wax Trax and then pronounced it the best record store they'd ever seen. And keep in mind, these are guys from New York.
Yeah.
And they needed an opener, and so there was a local punkish band called the Ravers. And suddenly, if they're going to have a high profile thing opening for the Ramones to the handful of us who were there the night before, they were going to need roadies. So all of a sudden, me and Joseph, my friend Sam Turner, we were the roadies for the Ravers. Fell 10 feet tall. All you people said I was a loser in school and my family had never amounted to anything. Look at me now. I am a roadie for the Ravers. God damn it. And it was also the Ramones were very down to earth and would talk to you and stuff, very nice people. And, you know, they signed my albums, which I'd never have had anybody do that before. I mean, Leave Home had just come out, so.
And you still have those records, I bet.
Of course, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And it's also, you know, the reason, you know, I try to, you know, if it isn't like the absolute wrong time to do it, yeah, I'll try and sign people's stuff.
Yeah.
Within reason, because it's, you know, can't forget how I felt when the Ramones signed my album.
So had you seen the Ravers before they had that opening?
No.
That was your first time seeing them. Were you aware of them? And, like, how did you...
A little bit. And they'd gotten a little bit of a write-up. I can't remember whether the term punk was even used. But just playing rock and roll was an act of rebellion in itself. Mm-hmm. In the Denver Boulder area, because it was so country, rocky, mellow, hanging, planty, don't harsh my mellow type people, that this was all a breath of fresh air. And the singer was Mark Campbell, who already had been something of a controversy seeking beat poet in town, and then apparently reading a nude at least once, and so she had to do to get attention in Boulder. And he was writing reviews for the Colorado Daily, the college paper, and he was a little more in-your-face about it than a lot of other people were. So I was like, oh, well, this is kind of a character. Oh, he's in this band. Oh, this is the kind of guy who should have his own band. And what do you know? It was a good band, too.
Yeah.
And listening to the recordings that survived, which, you know, are not the highest quality, but at least they're there. In retrospect, they had more of a 60s garage sound, and even the very, very early ones from 76, they almost sound more like Steely Dan, with a very strong reggae influence from the beginning and stuff.
They signed to a major, right, at some point?
Well, they eventually moved to New York, and Rick Stott was their manager by then. He took them to New York, and they only kept one roadie, which was Sam Turner, and really, really had a struggle there, as people who go, especially to New York, chasing a dream do. Mm-hmm. I was kind of bummed they left me behind, but that turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because I went west instead, and where the scene was a lot younger in average age, because it wasn't all over 21 clubs and stuff. And so eventually they had enough of a identity crisis. They changed their name to The Nails, and there were some personnel changes. I think Mark and Dave Kaufman, the keyboardist, might have been the only ones eventually by the time that The Nails had their big hit, 88 Lines About 44 Women. It's the same band. You know, that band started as the Ravers in Colorado. Now you know.
And now, you had a band, too, shortly thereafter, right? Like, the Healers?
That wasn't really a band.
Did you have a band, though, in Colorado? It was that compilation that has
It was me and my friend John Greenway and sometimes Sam Turner, you know, waiting. If one of our places and the parents weren't home, you turn on a cassette recorder and go add instruments you don't know how to play and see what happens.
But some of those songs have been released now, right? There's a compilation.
Rocky Mountain Low.
So when you were looking at, because you moved to go to university, right? Or you just moved to get out of Colorado?
Both.
Okay. Were you thinking of other places other than San Francisco or other than Bay Area?
I mainly looked at Evergreen State College and universities of California at Santa Cruz, because they didn't have grades and they didn't have fraternities and sororities and a big sports thing. And so that was the attraction. And also was like, oh, Evergreen's kind of close to Seattle. And then it slowly dawned on me, you know, the Santa Cruz was closer to San Francisco. And by the time I actually got there, word had gotten out about crime and the nuns and that there was punk stuff going on there, too. And me and another punk-leaning guy named Michael Ellis, who I met at UC Santa Cruz, we went to the Mabue for the first time. Oh, wow, we're going to go see some punk rock. And we pay to get in, and then we find out it's metal night. And metal at that point doesn't mean cool metal. No. It means 70s dinosaur cheese metal, and not even hair band cheese. I mean, in other words, mostly weak hard rock that its time had come and gone. So I would say, seeing the way those bands acted and what they sounded like and whatnot, it really kind of crystallized for me the division between 70s hard rock and punk. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can imagine which way I went. And sure enough, eventually another punk rocker appeared, and, you know, dressed in an old suit and a tie and a white shirt, just, you know, making faces at one of the metal bands and going out of his way to annoy them as much as possible. And then Mike said, oh my God, I think I know that guy. That's Russell. And it turned out, yep, it was Russell Wilkinson, who they'd gone to a high school for Americans in London, I think. And Taylor, but now he's changed his name to Will Shatter. And he was like, oh, hi, are you in a band? No, I can't really play anything or anything. Why does that matter? I've been playing bass for 2 days and I'm in a band. We're playing tomorrow night. And so that was the first real punk show. It was a little lower floor, a little warehouse space, and the Avengers were the main band. And then the band that Will was in, it really did sound like he'd been playing bass for 2 days. But they were called Grand Mall.
Did they record anything? Did they go on?
No, they didn't last very long. But the singer for Grand Mall was Don Vinyl, who went into the Offs.
Oh, wow.
And Will and Craig Gray started Negative Trend.
Holy.
So that's what Grand Mall was.
So a significant band, nonetheless. Did you see like Patti Smith when she came through Colorado? And were did any like Talking Heads, or were you gone by that point?
I was gone by that point. I did see Talking Heads at UC Santa Cruz, of all places.
Oh, yeah.
The 77 album came out and enjoyed that.
So, like, I guess...
The only time I ever met David Byrne was they were doing a record store in-store, a little store in Santa Cruz that was hip to punk and new wave and other things called Cymbeline. And I tried describing the different little concept mini campuses, mini colleges at UC Santa Cruz, most of which were named after different corporations, and they were playing at Kresge College, and I described it partway to him, and then, having never been there, he finished my sentence and described it really well.
Very astute guy even then.
Yeah, of course.
I guess, like, what was it like going from, like, kind of that embryonic kind of punk scene that you left in Denver and in Colorado to like San Francisco, where, like you said, crime's already happened, there's the Avengers going on, and it seems like things are really going off.
Yeah, they were. And so after one quarter of college, I left and then went back to Boulder to get some money together, doing very dirty aromatic laundry at a nursing home, and then got the money together and went back out.
And, like, so when you first got there... Man, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. So when you first got there, like, who are some of the bands that... You know, I mentioned the Avengers, Grand Mall, obviously, now, too. But who are some of the other bands that were kind of ruling the roost of that? But Crime had already broken up, right?
No.
Oh, they were still going?
Very much so, yeah. I had seen Crime before I went back from Santa Cruz and seen Avengers. Dills hadn't moved up yet, but they came up and played in a double bill with the Zeros. That was my second real punk show. Trying to think of what else. And Iggy came through too. And then when I got back, again, I'd driven like... I just crashed by the side of the road and woke up at dawn in Utah, drove all the way to San Francisco and dropped off some stuffs and then went straight to the Mabuhay. And, oh, this band called Negative Trend is playing with the Nuns. And, oh, okay. And I walk in, oh my God, it's Will, it's Craig, and it's a much wilder singer. That would be Roz. And they've got a drummer who can play now and stuff. And, And then out came the Nuns, who were kind of, they had a little bit of a jock audience by then, and I felt they were playing up to them and stuff. And it quickly became apparent that, like, you know, we owe it for the first generation Crime and the Nuns, and Merry Monday was the other one from very early on. But then, you know, I quickly kind of allied myself with the Avengers, the group that was the Avengers, Dills, Mutants, Sleepers, UXA, Negative Trend. That was generation number two. And they were much more of a community and cooperated with each other and traded off headlines and whatnot. And whereas if you opened for Crime, there would only be one other band on the bill, you, and they would take almost all the money and stuff. So
who was that Mary Monday? What was that other person you said, Mary Monday?
Or yeah.
Who's, I've never heard
she
that.
She just fronted a punk band for a while, which was gone by the time I moved back. There is a single, though, called I Gave My Punk Jacket to Ricky.
Oh, that's that band.
Yeah, I've that's heard Mary that Monday. Song. Yeah, oh, that's crazy. Yeah. Somebody took the time to actually fold the paper sleeve over so it met across the middle and back and safety pinned them all shut and stuff.
Were the Maggots from San Francisco?
That was later. That's later, though. Yeah. I'm not sure that was ever a live band, but...
it was just like a studio project?
I think it was just, a one-off studio project of people having fun, yeah.
Oh, crazy. That's amazing. So, I guess, like, where did your influence come from? Because, like... Everyone you talk to that's into hardcore and punk that kind of got into it early on says that it was hearing the Dead Kennedys and hearing, you know, your vocal delivery that kind of like awakened them to this aggression in punk. Where was that?
How could that possibly have influenced you, Mr. Cookie Monster?
Well, I'm influenced
all
by...
All the people go...
I'm influenced by you influencing Jerry A, influencing me. So it's your influence.
I think
there.
You might be overrating my influence.
No, but I'm talking about Gerard Cosloy. I'm talking about like people that were into like the first wave on the East Coast, it was the Dead Kennedys tour. That was the first time a lot of them got to see it. Like, you know, like, or and Flag too early on as well.
Well, that there were two early Dead Kennedys tours over there, and one we went over as an unknown band, and California Uber Alice showed up from the pressing plant partway when we were there. The Offs had been out, the Screamers had been out, and wowed everybody. And people, yeah, you got to go to New York. You got to go to New York. And of course, we got there, and it was a very, very difficult thing.
Yeah.
And here you can play at Max's, and you'll play two sets opening for Voodoo Shoes. They will headline because Jimmy Destri from Blondie's sister is in the band. That was how far the club scene had sunk. It was like everybody, it was an X something or other.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. And the Misfits existed, but I could never find them. I love that Bullet EP, but I could never find them. And then I saw posters for the Mad on the street, but didn't realize how good they were till I brought the single home from there. I was like, oh my God, is this good? So, but I don't even know whether the thing I saw advertised even happened when I was there or not. I don't remember. But, so it was a rough one. It was kind of like, you know, I don't think I was the only person in the band thinking, well, now we've done New York and that, I think we kind of run our course here. But maybe I'll wait and see what happens when the single comes out, just in case something happens. And needless to say, something happened.
Yeah.
So then the next time we were out, Fresh Fruit had done really well in England. And so then, months later, did it come out in the United States. And so there was suddenly kind of a high-profile tour of the East Coast. And because we came from the West Coast, where things were fiercer for the most part, and plus it was also one of the things that made the Mabuhay scene so magical and brought in the kind of people it did, was that it was all ages, as were a lot of the shows in L.A., and I believe Vancouver as well. And that, you know, the best time to do these kind of things is when you're too young to know better.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, we knew that was really, really important at that point, especially after seeing what the Over 21 thing had done, where the CBGB's bands we all know had gotten way bigger, so they didn't play there anymore. And then there was this kind of snobby thing called the Mud Club, where you had to wait outside, and maybe the doorman thinks you're cool enough and you can come in, and that's how you got in. And then they would never announce if anybody was playing there. So then, did you hear DNA played the Mud Club last night? And we weren't there. And I'm like, what kind of ledge scene is this? This is stupid. This is evil. And so we came back, we insisted on all ages shows as much as we could possibly get them, and that was what brought a lot of people in. I mean, the one that I really didn't dig was having to go on stage at noon, because that was the only time a venue would let us play if it was going to be an all ages show. And the New York music press said we were stooping to gimmicks because we were letting all underage people into our shows. I got so many letters for the next, God, I don't know, almost 10 years from people, even grunge bands and stuff later on, saying, yeah, our first exposure to punk or anything was that show.
Yeah.
At Bond's Casino, so at least it did for a lot of people what the Ramones did for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot to mention, with that Ramones show at Ebbets Field, what that turned out to be the cradle of: Dead Kennedys, The Nails, Angst, Velvet Monkeys, and Gumball, because Don Fleming was at that show.
He's a Colorado.
He was in the Air Force, and he was stationed at Lowry Air Force Base in Denver. And, of course, the Wax Trax label, when Jim and Danny sold the store and moved to Chicago and started another Wax Trax, you can count that one in as well. And Al Jorgensen claims he was at that show too, but nobody knew him at the time or anything.
Well, that's before he did special effects or any of those
things,
right?
Yeah.
So
he did briefly live in Colorado, yeah.
You also, though, on that Big Dead Kennedys tour, you were picking out all those opening acts, right?
No, that was after that.
That was after that.
Because we learned our lesson with that first tour is sometimes friends of promoter who don't belong on a bill with just about anybody would be getting the gigs and stuff.
Did you play with anyone?
There was a mob joint in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and the new wavy goofy pop band turned out to be rather thug-like and stuff. And the promoter in Philadelphia actually had us play with a cheesy old school metal band, not good old school metal band with swastika armbands on.
Whoa.
Called Earthling.
Wow.
Because he thought it might be funny or something. I don't know. Well, sorry, Lee, it wasn't funny. And we tried where we could, but we weren't able to get that many people. You know, although at least in Providence, Rhode Island, they had the Freeze open for us.
Oh, that's awesome.
Back when they just had that 1/7 inch with
tourists.
The ballad. Yeah, with the ballad on the other side. Took me forever to find one that they hadn't scratched the B-side out with scissors on. And it wasn't that bad a song.
No.
God. At least in Washington, D.C., we got to play with half Japanese.
Oh, that's fucking awesome.
So when they were arriving, me and Klaus looked at each other like we feel like kids and we're about to meet the Beatles or something, because we were so into half Japanese. And they didn't disappoint. And of course, by then the Teen Idols had been out to West and back, so I'd met Ian and Henry and Nathan Strashek and some of the others. And so, God, I hope they show up. I hope those people show up. And oh yeah, you know, DC felt like home after that and stuff. And I personally, even though I'm not straight edge, I really identified with the attitude because I came from Drug City.
Yeah.
And some people had already died and stuff. And one of my roommates was an alcoholic who'd started doing speed and was even selling it. And, you know, if you like the addict, you'll love their friends. And so having this instead and noticing how much more energy they had and stuff was a real breath of fresh air to me.
Yeah, you know, you talked about how hard it was on that first tour to pick bands that would open for you, and I would imagine, because it seems like, you know, these tours, like you're saying, like a lot of these bands that are writing to you saying that was my first exposure to punk was going to that Dead Kennedys show. So many people I've talked to talk about how that was like the birth of the scene, and then how like so many bands that were at that those shows would wind up kind of forming, or so many people would wind up forming bands that were at those shows together. And
then maybe well into the next year, I think, was, or maybe even before that, was when Black Flag really started doing extensive American touring. And, you know, they got into a lot of cities we had never played in, too. Mm-hmm. So, they were helping plant a lot of other seeds and cracking open scenes. And, you know, either there would already be one band kind of starting or there might be more. And Chuck and I would trade tips from time to time on some places and stuff.
And DOA was on the circuit by this point, too, right?
Yeah, I think Black Flag and DOA had more to do with cracking open the rest of North America than Dead Kennedys did.
Yeah, no, I think it's but I obviously you guys cracked open a lot of North America, but I think that East Coast tour, and that's really like, you know, not the birth of East Coast hardcore, but like you can tell that's like the germ that would help
Because when we played at the 930 Club in D.C. and those guys showed up, you know, they gave me cassette demos of Minor Threat and the D.C. Youth Brigade and Void and Law and Order was another one, Government Issue too. So they were all on their way. And then at the end of the tour, DOA came through up. I can't remember where I met them, probably in New York, but then I rode down with Joey. He and his wife were traveling separately as some kind of a get-together getaway in their car on that tour. So DOA were playing a high school cafeteria, which the students with names like Ian and others had talked the school into letting them do it. So that was the show.
Yeah.
You know, DOA and Minor Threat and SOA and Scream was on that bill and was not really down with the DC hardcore kids yet, although obviously that changed in a year or two and quite nicely. And I think Government Issue played, but we didn't get there in time to see GI. Yeah, I think I walked in when SOA was on the stage.
So, like, you know, at that point, also with DOA, too, like, they sound so different than those other bands, but I guess it's just the energy that unites everyone.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, I had hung out with Henry in particular beforehand and then came back and stayed in his apartment. And, you know, and he'd seen half Japanese and they played with us. And you know how Henry is a man of passionate opinions. He's, I will follow them anywhere. And then he really liked DOA, too. So that was cool.
Was he collecting records back then,
yeah,
too?
Yeah.
So, like...
He had a different kind of collecting, because like he would find bands he liked and then get every different edition of certain records. And luckily for him and others, there was a store out in Rockville, Maryland called Yesterday and Today, run by Skip Groff, who had the Limp label on his own. And I do believe he financed the original Minor Disturbance EP for Discord and the Teen Idols, and then just kind of let him take it from there. And just very, very supportive. Plus, another one of those stores that it would take you a month to go through it all.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I mean, there was a section a foot and a half long of every local record Link Ray had played on. That not all of them good, but, you know, because he just, you know, they knew where to put all that stuff. And then later, one of the co-founders of Touch and Go, Dave Stimson, moved out, and he was working at Yesterday and Today. So... boy, do they have amazing things. New stuff that they'd import and older stuff, too.
Well, that's how the Bad Brains heard the Vowel Tones. And apparently they used to cover... they did used to cover Screaming Fist in their set. So that's the...
that would make sense.
That's a Canadian DC connection right to that store right there.
That would make sense. Boy, on that miserable 79 tour, man, if only we'd known about the Bad Brains.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I heard that Black Dots record. And I was like, oh, my God. They were that good, that early, and that West Coast sounding, and none of us knew who they were.
But were there other bands that you saw on that early tour that you were like, okay, this is...
You're mixing up two early tours.
I mean, on that first tour that was disastrous, where you said you...
Oh, yeah. The Neighborhoods.
Oh, yeah.
Their records don't even begin to do them justice.
Really?
But when I saw them live, they were so explosive, so charismatic, really great songs. And, you know, I thought, you know, this is a magic kind of combination of the Jam and the Dills. This band is going to be huge. But didn't happen.
Like, and then when you kind of went back out on that next tour, where there were more bands that you kind of like, you know, kindred spirit type things. Who were some of the bands that you felt like, I guess it's on the Let Them Eat Jelly Beans comp, like the bands that were really kind of connected?
Yeah. Younger fans we met afterwards. Why are you the only good band in America? And I'm like, haven't you ever heard of Black Flag? Haven't you ever heard of DOA? Haven't you ever... No.
Every band on that comp.
And so, you know, originally the concept for Let Them Eat Jelly Beans was to relaunch Alternative Tentacles as a real label. And do a compilation for Britain to show Britain what else is going on that they're missing. And little did we know it would have a bigger impact on the European continent than it did in England, although it did well there too. And then it got released in America and had a big effect over there as well. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to make sure it wasn't just all punk bands. I put punk on one side and the more unusual stuff, or stuff I thought was really well done but not getting proper attention, on the other. I mean, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, OMD, had just started to catch in England. I thought, wait a minute, Voice Farm's as good as they are, and there's this really cool song. Let's put that on at the end. You know, I wanted to show the variety and not just put blinders on.
Well, that's why that compilation, I think, stands up today so well, is because unlike a lot of compilations from that time, it's right, it exposes punk as being this huge spectrum of sounds.
Yeah, unfortunately, it'll never come out again in any form. I mean, we got contracts on all those songs for a whopping 3 years. It seemed like such a long time. And then it came time later, hey, we should put this back out again, and trying to clear it with everybody. We ran into all kinds of people who got more businessy and stuff and whatnot. We wouldn't be able to do it again.
Well, Jello, I've talked to you for a long time, and I want to talk to you for way longer, but I'm not going to ruin your night and force you to sit here and talk to me forever. But we got to talk about this moment in history in Canada and your key involvement in it, because you, in my opinion, are the impetus for Canada's cannabis legalization.
I find that really hard to believe.
Well, you know, Canada's Prince of Pot, who I will say on the record, definitely don't agree with him on a lot of other issues, but I do agree with him about cannabis, but his exposure to cannabis was entirely through being a fan of you and your work.
And that would be Dave Emery?
Mark Emery. No, Mark is a controversial figure in Canada, but it's like amazing. Like, once again, I think to me, nothing illustrates how important this genre, this novelty genre that died in 1978, is for the world, because through Jello Biafra and the Dead Kennedys, who have influenced tons of people musically, but Jello Biafra also affected real prohibition change when it comes to cannabis.
Well, it's always nice to help start fires. I guess to fill it in here, you were explaining a little more to me in the car, yes, what Emery has done and how he suffered for his vision, and claiming that he didn't realize all the medicinal value, and, you know, and when you make it into paper and clothing and everything else and save the forest, until I did my Grow More Pot spoken word piece, which is off the I Blow Minds for a Living spoken word album, the third one. And he had brought me into London, Ontario. I think maybe if he really is crediting me, which I'm still having a hard time believing, that I would have that much impact like that. I really, there's got to be more to it than that.
Well,
but anyway,
you mentioned The Emperor Has No Clothes.
Right, book, right. By Jack Harrer.
Which, yeah, he tried to order and was a banned book in Canada at the time.
Oh.
And he found out that all marijuana books and magazines and publications, anything that promoted cannabis, was illegal in Canada. So he starts smuggling that stuff in just to be anti-censorship. And it starts selling really well for him. So he started bringing in High Times magazine. That started selling really well for him. So eventually he started bringing in Jack Hare and all these writers, and eventually converted himself to becoming cannabis activist.
I think some of the activism was going on by the time he brought me in, because he made it clear he was very anti-censorship,
yes,
and was already running into trouble with authorities over one thing or another.
Yes, at that point, but he had not realized about cannabis activism until you blew his mind for a living.
He might have heard the album and then brought me in.
I think that he did. He heard the album and then brought you in afterwards.
Yeah.
But it was really, but it, like, once again though, that, you know, he was into activism. He was into anti-censorship stuff. He was running for libertarian in the London government, but it wasn't the cannabis stuff yet. That is entirely where he gives credit to you on. So who would ever think that you would become the biggest pothead?
And he's crediting me with this.
He credits you with it. Wow, yeah, 100%. Well, and because he says,
thanks,
that.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, I think, like,
again, glad to be the gateway drug. Glad to be of disservice to all the people with their stupid goddamn war on drug laws. What I said is, speaking of laws and stuff, at the Rockfest in Quebec we just played at, you know, it was only little 30-minute infomercial sets from a lot of the punk bands, mm-hmm, on the smaller so-called Tony Sly stages. Even so, I couldn't keep my mouth shut, and it occurred to me what to say during the middle portion of California Uber Alice was that there used to be really good asylum laws in Canada that Pierre Trudeau put in to help, in his way, bring an end to the Vietnam War, and it certainly did, because so many people fled to Canada so they couldn't be drafted and sent off to kill and to die and whatnot, including a close friend of my family who lives in Jasper to this day. And then after 9/11, I think after the Iraq invasion, when it looked like Clown Prince W might actually start drafting people, and they were talking about going into Syria and North Korea and maybe trying to go after Chavez in Venezuela and whatnot, one of Bush's guys on the Pentagon Advisory Council even said, let's not forget Lebanon has a blood debt to us because of the Marines that got blown up when Reagan was president. I mean, it was just nuts. Mm-hmm. Nuts to the point where the Homeland Security people pressured Jean Chrétien into getting rid of those asylum laws so you can no longer flee America to Canada simply because you're trying to avoid being sent to war or subjected to any number of other horrible things that might be done by somebody like President Trump or President Mike Pence or whatever. So my plea to the audience there was to start pressuring your MPs and everybody else to pressure Justin Trudeau and your national parliament to, for crying out loud, change those asylum laws back to the way they were. Because if Trump really does, you know, at 5 in the morning when he can't sleep, run out of, his phone dies, so he has to launch a nuclear bomb at North Korea instead, and then, or launch it at Tehran or whatever, then all hell breaks loose and people are going to have somewhere to go to flee the policies of the Trumpkins.
Yeah, it's like it's a really scary time, and it's very frightening to think that, not frightening, but, you know, comforting, I guess, maybe even, that we're living in a world that you sung about for years. You've been singing about the world we're in.
Yeah, and rapping about it, too. And I thought many years ago, you know, maybe I should quit writing these worst-case scenario things because they keep coming true.
Exactly. Maybe you should take a page from the Ravers Nails book and maybe go a little new wave now.
I only can do what comes out of me.
Well, Jello,
better at writing some stuff than other things.
This has been amazing. Thank you for the inspiration. Thanks for doing this.
All right. Well, you don't have a bad band yourself, dude. Where's all the new little weird 7-inches you'd usually bring me?
We got to go to my house. We'll go to my house now. So, Zolar X, you're saying you didn't find him at a record store?
No, I mean, I knew about them even during their heyday in the glam scene. And I was somebody who still, I liked the idea of dangerous hippies. I had long hair and whatnot and, you know, greasy, zit-encrusted freak. And the freaks wore that label proudly, like people who would call themselves queer would take an insult and turn it around later. And I'm grateful there were so many freaks in my school because of the university and of Colorado, the professors, the scientific institutes, those people's kids and whatnot. There were so many weird people at Boulder High and even in the other more suburban jock school, Fairview, that we never even all knew each other and stuff. And but that was where I was at. I mean, when they started pushing, now the way to rebel children is to wear platform shoes and put lipstick on and get a goofy-ass modified crew-cut mullet like David Bowie. And I was like, no, 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 none of these people are going to tell me what to do. And I don't think I'm the only person who felt that way, and I think that was one of the reasons that glam failed as a street movement in the way that punk succeeded. Punk, you made your own look. Mm-hmm. And it scared the shit out of a lot more people, too. But anyway, one day on a sidewalk, I found this magazine called Rock Scene. I'd never seen it before, and it was either Lenny Kaye or Lester Bangs. I think Lenny Kaye, it was his magazine. There are pictures of Wayne County in there. Like, who is this? And then they had a section in Rock Scene where people could send in pictures of their own band and describe themselves. They were trying to push new bands and things. And here was one of Zolar X, you know, with pointed ears and other things. It was actually a review of them or something. And when they played, and I was like, this is the most ridiculous band I've ever seen. But then the review described them as a cross between Pink Floyd and Black Sabbath. So I thought, wow, I wonder what they sounded like. Years and years later, on a box on the floor at Aquarius Records in San Francisco, I find what turns out to be a Zolar X bootleg, the clear vinyl one.
That's what
turned out, well, in a way it is, but yeah. Weigar's, the guitar player in Zolar X, basically bootlegged his own band after the fact and pressed them up himself. It's like, okay, this is going to be, I have to hear this band. And I put it on, and it just blew me through the wall. It was so much better than I ever thought it was going to be. And it was kind of like, to me, it was like the missing link between Chrome and Cheap Trick, or Chrome and the Stooges or something. I was just so impressed. Like, God, if I can ever find these people, this needs a real release and stuff. And years later, a guy interviewing me about the Evil Dead Kennedys lawsuit said in passing that he knew where Weigar was. And I'm not sure Weigar's name was even on the bootleg. He's like, oh, that's one of them. And he has all the masters. It's like, oh, my God. So I went out to see Weigar, who was living in Nevada and in Fallon at the time, and sharing a double wide, I think it was with his mom and stuff. And sure enough, he had him and everything. And, you know, that proved to be quite the rebirth of Weigar himself, where, you know, he was so happy it had come out, and suddenly all this energy came back, and he'd been sober for many, many years. So, I'm just so happy about this. Hey, we're getting new costumes made right now. We're going to start playing again. I thought, uh-oh, what have I done?
They've got sure enough, records. Great records.
Yeah, I mean, plus it turned out to be a decent live band. And, of course, Weigar just getting to play his music again and everything, it was just meant so much to him. I mean, he wrote most of the music, as far as I know, and he came from a family of classical musicians and stuff.
Uh-oh.
He might have been trained classical on violin, or that might have been one of the other ones. I don't know. His real name is Stephen Della Bosca.
And one of them went on to be in, like, a Kill by Death band, too, right? Like, who got killed
in prison. That was Weigar. Yeah, that was Weigar.
Well, I could talk to you about every record you put on AT, but we'll leave it at this one. Jello, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping, you know, they make all these documentaries and biopics, and there is a Zolar X one that's kind of been in limbo for a while, a documentary. And if there ever ought to be a biopic just to the adventures of those guys, well, you read about it in the liner notes on the album. Somebody was stealing pointed ears off the Star Trek set and bringing them to them so they would have a supply of them. And their spacesuits came from ski shops.
Oh, there's just so many. They're like the missed success opportunities when, like, Ace Frehley missed them by, like, one band that they talk about in the liner notes.
There was another producer who wanted to make them into the next Monkees.
Oh, yeah, the TV show.
I can't
show.
Remember what one of them did at that meeting that made them decide they never wanted that band in the same room with them again. But,
once again, as I say, I could talk to you about this forever, and I'm sure we will talk about Zolar X.
Apparently, sometimes they'd even go in costume to Hollywood parties and talk in a space alien language to each other.
Yeah, they never broke character.
Which apparently, supposedly, Ron Ashton got so disgusted with that one night, he punched out Weigar outside.
Oh, my God, that's awesome.
Yeah, I even have a Zolar X name now.
You do?
Yeah.
What's your Zolar X name?
Weigar renamed me Zaxxion Viceroy. I think with two X's.
Thank you, Jello, for coming on the show. And Jello Biafra will be back for part two. There's no way I can let him get away with only doing that, because that was awesome. There's a lot more to get to, of course, with Jello. Hopefully there'll be part 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. But once again, there would not have been a part 1. Assuredly, there would not have been a part 1 if it had not been for Melanie and Eric. Melanie and Eric, thank you both so much. And Kayla, who babysat my kids for me, thank you for extending the time that you could babysit for them, because this thing ended up taking 12 hours to get done. So thank you, Kayla. Thank you, Melanie. And thank you, Eric, because this was a super, super fun episode. And thank you, my kids, for understanding that Daddy wasn't going to be home that night because I was out record shopping. And also, I'm going to plug two places that we went record shopping at. Cops, you know, check out Cops, but also check out Grasshopper Records as well. Two great stores. Jello freaked out over both of them. Really fun times. Cops, if you're looking for 45s. Grasshopper, if you're just looking for a great place to hang out in the city. Grasshopper is one of the coolest record store owners. It's just a really fun place to hang out. And trust me, we hung out in both those places for hours and hours. And also Bear Witness from A Tribe Called Red, who came out and hang out too. It was a fun-ass day. I'm telling you, this was a crazy, fun day involving hanging out with lots of friends. So, yeah, we'll explain the whole story on Footnotes in an upcoming edition of Footnotes, the other podcast, which we haven't had a chance to do in forever. Sorry, Chris. Anyway, I got to go get on this plane because I got to go to New York so I can do this live podcast. So come out early if you are in New York or Brooklyn, I should say, sorry, for the House of Vans, the Royal Headache Show with, of course, the Downtown Boys. I'm going to be doing live podcast there. Thank you very much again to Van Shoes for making this thing possible and for bringing me down there. And go over to houseofvans.com to find out more information about upcoming House of Vans events and cool things like maybe Turn It a Punk popping up there. That's pretty cool. And that's about it for today's show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, anyone can do this. Go out there and make your own culture. And yeah, just keep fighting for what you want to do. You know, keep fighting for what you believe in. Keep fighting for the stuff you want to make, because eventually you'll be able to do that. Anyway, I'm home for a minute. I'm gonna pack my bag before I have to head out the door again. But it's a lot of fun. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Love you, and I will see you next week.